religious liberty is a tremendously important value, the first of our freedoms in the Bill of Rights. But more important, I think, than that is that religions have given answers to those fundamental existential questions which all human beings must face: the nature of sin and salvation, the nature of hope, the nature of tragedy, the nature of forgiveness, mercy, love, compassion, community, tradition. You can't be well educated if you don't understand the religious answers that have been given to those fundamental concerns of our culture.
Educator Warren Nord. His new book is Religion and American Education, A Fresh Appraisal of a National Dilemma. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. With the possible exception of the era when New World Puritanism saw itself as a city upon a hill, when church and state were closely aligned, the role of religion in our public schools and universities has always been controversial. But lately it's become especially troublesome. Conservatives seek to restore religious purposes and practices to public education, while liberals generally find religion irrelevant to the curriculum. A new study of this national dilemma offers some fresh perspectives. The book is Religion and American Education. The author is Warren Nord. He says that public schools and universities must be diligent not to promote religion. But this doesn't mean we should neglect philosophical, political, moral, and constitutional reasons for requiring our young people to study religion. Warren Nord directs the program in the Humanities and Human Values at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Warren, my old friend, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
It is my pleasure to be here, Wayne.
Congratulations on this wonderful book that you have done. It is Religion and American Education. You describe it as a national dilemma. Why did you write this book?
There isn't any such book. It's, of course, a very important topic. Our culture wars are filled with discussions about the role of religion and education. One would think there would be a vast literature on the subject, but there isn't. Mm-hmm. When I started looking into the area 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I discovered that very little had been written. The scholarly establishment education has virtually ignored the subject. Mm-hmm. So there was a need for someone to take a comprehensive look at these issues.
Let's see if we can skin this cat from a number of different angles, Warren Nord. Why is it, as a generality, that religion is absent from American education?
Well, a lot of folk think that it's because the courts have taken religion out of public schools, public universities. That's not the case. Of course, the Supreme Court has said you can't pray in schools, you can't read the Bible devotionally, but they've never said that you can't study religion. Religion disappeared from textbooks, from the curriculum, pretty much by the end of the 19th century, at least 50, 60 years before the Supreme Court issued any ruling having to do with religion in public schools. So it's not the courts. The reasons have much to do with how the United States became a secular society, how the West became secular. Mm-hmm. Religion disappeared from the curriculum, from textbooks, because we have become essentially a secular culture.
How would you describe that kind of arc, Warren, where we move from the New England Primer and the city on the hill, that wonderful metaphor that organized Puritan life or much of Puritan life, to the society that we live in now that, as you say, is almost utterly secular when it comes to our educational values?
Well, there are a lot of factors. I suppose primarily it's that science and social science have given us new ways of understanding nature, human nature, society, ways of understanding the world that don't involve God, don't involve religious categories. Mm-hmm. I think it's also the case that liberal social institutions, and here I don't mean left-wing of the Democratic Party social institutions, but the kind of liberal institutions, democracy, capitalism, have been institutions which have not relied on or even allowed much space for religion in our culture.
Well, you know, the word dilemma figures in your title, Warren Nord, and let's pursue that for a moment. On the one hand, it is a given that the American people somehow or other is a religious people, more more than half of us go to church. We have a wonderful variety of religious expressive cultures in the United States. And yet in our educational system, religion is astonishingly absent. Is there a quick way to account for that discrepancy?
No, but nonetheless, I'll take a shot at it. Yes, of course, we're religious in the sense that we believe in God. Most of us go to church or synagogue, probably the majority of us. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, our religion often is limited to a set of beliefs that don't have much of anything to do with how we live our lives. The wall of separation that's perhaps most interesting is not the wall of separation between the constitutional wall between church and state, but the wall of separation that exists in our intellectual life.
Right.
That is to say, our intellectual disciplines, our ways of understanding the world, became divorced from religion some time ago, and religion plays no role in those disciplines now.
Is it true, Warren, that the United States government as a government, that is to say, the legal system that we all attempt to live with and under, is it hostile, neutral? What word should we use when we describe the relationship between the judiciary, let's be specific, and religious belief?
Well, of course, different folk would give you very different takes on that question. The Establishment Clause is probably the relevant clause of the Constitution here, the First Amendment. And the courts have interpreted it to mean that there should be a wall of separation between church and state. The phrase comes from Thomas Jefferson, not from the Constitution. It was read into the reading of the Establishment Clause in 1947 by Justice Black.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that means hostility, that government can't have anything at all to do with religion, can't provide any kind of support. But in that 1947 decision, Justice Black said, what we mean by the wall of separation, in large part at least, is that government should be neutral between, not just among religions, between Baptists and Methodists or Protestants and Catholics or Christians and Jews, but neutral between religion and non-religion. It's not the job of the state at any level to either promote religion or denigrate religion.
And how does that logic find its way into our schools? We have lots of words that we could consider here. Indoctrination, neutrality, tolerance, objectivity, sympathy, this wonderful panoply in the vocabulary.
And they're all loaded terms.
Absolutely.
Difficult to sort out.
Right.
Courts would say that, I think by and large most courts would say, the Supreme Court would say that public schools should be neutral on questions of religion. If a teacher got up in a public school and said, you've got to believe in God or you can't believe in God, anyone could sue the school system and get the teacher to not say those kinds of things anymore. The more interesting question perhaps has to do with subtler forms of neutrality. Sure, teachers can't overtly endorse or proselytize or indoctrinate religiously or can't do the opposite, can't be hostile to religion. But when are you subtly being supportive of promoting religion? When are you subtly being hostile to religion? That's a much trickier question. And again, we aren't really taught to think through those kinds of questions very carefully at all.
When recently, as I understand it, the courts have given not permission, but they have prodded the University of Virginia, to be specific, to endorse or subsidize, help to subsidize a religiously oriented publication on campus. Now, how would you unpack that issue, Warren? Is that a question of the law? Is it a question of religious belief, a secular interpretation of what happens in a religious context? Help me to understand.
It's an interesting decision. Of course, the case was settled in part on free speech grounds rather than on religion clause, establishment clause grounds. Nonetheless, you get an interesting breakdown in how the justices sorted it out. You have the four liberals, with quotes around liberals, I suppose, on the court, saying that the establishment clause really requires a strict separation. That is, you can't fund, the state cannot fund religious organizations. That's part of what the Establishment Clause has been taken to mean. It goes right back to Justice Black and his citing of Jefferson. Justice Black, as I mentioned earlier, also said the state's got to be neutral.
Uh-huh.
The five more conservative justices of the court picked up on neutrality and said, if you are willing to subsidize secular publications, but not religious. You're not being neutral. Neutrality would require that we treat religious ideas, religious viewpoints,
right,
the same way we do secular viewpoints. So the split on the court in that case really has to do with the two different aspects, two different ways of reading the Establishment Clause and the tensions between them.
Aren't we really fundamentally stuck with a contradiction? That is to say, our constitutional form of government thrives and encourages on the whole idea of competition and self-interested or enlightened self-interest, factionalism. When we apply that sort of constitutional or governmental framework to religion in our schools, teaching religious questions and teaching about religion, how can we expect anything but discord rather than all this hope for harmony in our schools?
Yeah, good question. I suppose I'd say that the whole idea of neutrality is of course very difficult, and there's no such thing as a neutral point of view. There's no such thing as an objective point of view, or at least what counts as being objective, what counts as being as being neutral is something that's deeply controversial.
The anthropologist disabused us of this notion a long time ago.
So then what does it mean? How in practice do we be neutral, or how in practice do we be objective in the classroom? And I think the only way is to be fair. That is to say, you allow different points of view voice in the classroom. If you allow secular voices to be heard, then you should allow religious voices.
Well, now
to
here
be heard.
We get into this question of the subtleties. That is to say, by what measures, by what standards, how much is too much, how much is not enough, when we say, all right, we're going to talk about religion rather than preaching a particular line.
No easy answers to that, but it's the kind of thing that educators have got to start thinking about. If students are exposed to entirely secular ways of thinking about nature and biology science courses, well, there are religious alternatives in our society. Some are fairly conservative, fundamentalistic. There are other more liberal ways of thinking about nature that involve God and the working out of purposes in nature. How do you provide the kind of balance that's necessary? How do you restore a measure of objectivity? How are you fair in those cases? Well, those are very, very tricky kinds of questions.
Well, nonetheless, toward the end of your book, Warren Nord, you invite American educators, you encourage them to teach a course in religion. I mean, you're telling them to walk into this morass, the perils of which you spend hundreds of pages describing.
Yes.
Now, what should be in that course? What if we have teachers listening to this conversation, and parents and students, give us a rough general sense of the contents of a course that all of our students should take in American religion, or religion in America?
Well, I suppose the first thing that I'd have to say is who teaches a course is tremendously important in how they're prepared. Right now, teachers in America schools are not prepared to deal in any very sophisticated way with religion. So the kinds of reforms I'm proposing really require that religious studies become a certifiable field in public schools the way it is in higher education. So you've got to have qualified teachers. You've got to have you've got to have good texts. Good texts are available now. There are a lot of them that are used in higher education, but that's easy. There are all kinds of people capable of writing good texts. Okay, then what do you actually deal with?
Yeah, what's the objective here? Does it have a sort of easily summarizable goal?
Sort of. there are, I mean, first of all, it's important for students and their parents to know what the purpose of such a course is. It's not to indoctrinate them. It's not to proselytize. It's not to make them religious. It's not to make them hostile to religion. It's to make them informed about religion. And I suppose I should say, to be clear here, religions rather than just religion.
This is what you call taking religion seriously.
Taking religion seriously. They've got to appreciate the fact that religion, to understand various religious traditions, is part of what it means to be an educated person. I think they should see something of the tensions, again, to get back to that notion, between secular ways of understanding history or nature, human psychology, society, morality, understand the tensions between secular ways of understanding those things and religious ways of understanding those things, both conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical, liberal.
How is this going to, the course, the hypothetical course that you're describing, Warren Nord, how is it going to work, the mechanics of it in our schools? Would it be, for example, elective? And if it's elective and kids reject it, parents tell their children not to take it, have we not defeated the purpose right there at the outset?
Well, no, I wouldn't have it be elective. I'd have it be a required course, but I think that there should be an excusal policy for students or parents whose consciences would be burdened by having their children, having the kids take that course. And in part, I believe that on First Amendment grounds, on given what the free exercise clause means, that that if this is going to be a course which is terribly burdensome, then students should be free to opt out of the course. Nonetheless, the school system should make the statement that we believe that it's tremendously important for students to understand something about different religious traditions as part of their liberal education.
Mm-hmm. When you were teaching religion in American schools, Warren Nord, you make in your book the argument that we should look at large words like world views, large words like pluralism, tolerance, multiculturalism. These are, again, dangerously loaded terms that in various hands find various expressions in our schools. How do we make sense of again, that panoply, that vocabulary?
Not easy to make sense of it, but my point, I suppose, would be that we're making virtually no effort to do that now. We simply float along without thinking seriously about religion, without thinking about what counts as a religious outlook, without thinking what are the basic assumptions, those assumptions that go without saying, mm-hmm. that pervade education, that have become part of the conventional wisdom, and that are explicitly, or at least implicitly, secular. We teach students in a very uncritical way to understand the world in fully secular categories. That marginalizes religion. It puts students in a position where they don't have the kinds of intellectual or emotional imaginative resources to take religion seriously.
You say, for example, that in your teaching at the University of North Carolina, you and a colleague administered a sort of religious literacy test to, what, about 150 kids?
150 students.
And what were the results here?
Well, I suppose not surprising. These were students taking philosophy and religion courses, mostly upperclassmen, and I thought it would be interesting. This was in the aftermath of E.D. Hirsch and cultural literacy, to find a little bit about the religious literacy of students. So we asked them some basic questions about the Bible, Western religious traditions, and world religions. 70% was to be my passing grade on a test of 30 questions.
It was considerably lower than that.
And 28% was the average, and nobody passed. Now, that may mean that I have absolutely no realistic notion about what it means to be religiously literate, but the ignorance of students really is rather striking. Only half of students can name the first two books of the Bible. Only 44% can come up with even the crudest approximation of the first of the Ten Commandments. 14% right. of the students could give some kind of definition of Zionism. 2% of students right. could identify Pope John the 23rd with the Second Vatican Council, probably the most important event in Christian history of the last 400 years.
Right. In one of our earlier conversations, Warren, didn't you point out to me that some students think that, how did you put it, that pilgrims are strange people who wear tall hats and take long trips?
Yeah, that's close. There's a middle school history or social studies textbook which describe pilgrims as people who make long trips, that is to say, working very hard to avoid any kind of religious reference in their definition of
right.
pilgrims, and textbooks do that over and over.
Again, Warren Nord, your book is Religion and American Education. Let's step back from, we've been generalizing and talking specifics at the same time here, and shift the burden of proof a little bit here. Are we not really, after all, talking about what goes on between parents and children? Should the burden for religious education, moral education, shouldn't that really reside in the home? Isn't that what the conservatives are telling us, that that's what we need to restore? Here you're making the argument for putting religion, not only putting religion in the schools, but taking it seriously and doing something critical with it when we put it there.
Well, yes, I'm making the case for religious education in the schools. Education is something different from indoctrination or
right.
socialization. It's perfectly proper for not just perfectly proper, but it's very important for parents to provide a religious upbringing for their children.
Well,
and whatever their religious traditions.
What if they don't? And they are essentially neutral or hostile or indifferent. We, as you say, we float along on the tides of our popular culture, which is, what, 1,000% secular. And this is, again, what the conservatives are complaining about. Who do we turn to when we try to figure out the role of religion in American education?
Well, the purpose of religious education, I guess my point would be, the purpose of education in schools and universities is quite different from the purpose of what parents and religious institutions should do. Religious institutions, it's not their job to provide a liberal education about various religious traditions and their relationship to secular traditions in the local church or synagogue or mosque. Right. Their task is very different. The task of education about these things in public schools is not one of initiating students into a particular religious tradition, but enabling them to think in an informed way about various kinds of religious traditions, to see what role they've had in our cultural institutions and how they interact with contemporary, more secular ways of understanding the world.
So this is what I take it, what you have in mind when you talk about resolving the dilemma. On the one hand, acknowledging moral education, theology, the doctrinal kind of thing, is something that exists, as it were, outside of the schools. But when it comes to understanding the importance of religion in our culture toward the goals of critical thinking, it does indeed have a legitimate place in our schools.
Yeah, although I think I'd maybe qualify your summary there a little bit and say that moral education is a very important purpose of public schools. And in some ways even of public universities. It is the task, I think, of public schools to make students into good people, at least in those areas where there's a broad consensus in our society as to what counts as a good person. Sure, it's mm-hmm. the job of public schools to help make kids honest, mm-hmm. to help make them work hard.
This is the whole idea
of
civitas, that is to say, civic virtue in the individual.
Civic virtue, but I'd even go beyond that and say moral virtue. Uh-huh. Religion has a role to play in that because common understandings of moral virtues and values in our society are often and have traditionally been rooted in religion. So I think a part of what should count as a good moral education is an awareness among students, particularly as they become older and more mature, of the religious roots of our moral virtues and values and traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So religion even has a role to play there. But again, it's not a matter of initiating students into a particular religious tradition or religion generally, but making them aware educationally as part of a good education about the religious foundations or roots of our various moral traditions. Here's another very important point. Religion is properly part of a liberal education, it seems to me. Liberal educations for students are old enough, mature enough to understand controversial things, to understand different points of view. I'm not for starting an intense religious education for elementary school kids. I'm sure they should learn something about, say, religious holidays or religious practices, those kinds of things that aren't particularly controversial. But when religion does become controversial, when it provides us with alternative ways of understanding, well, then that's part of a liberal education for older students.
Warren, your book, again, is Religion and American Education. You describe this topic as a dilemma. Let me present it to you from another angle as we move toward a conclusion of our conversation here. American education is fragmented. It is postage stamp. It exists at the local level. That's where decisions get made. The argument has been put forward that, you know, that the government should, that there should be no Department of Education because that is a local phenomenon. How realistically can you expect coherence, the development of critical thinking, a legitimate place for education about religion in our schools, when it all comes down to these tiny little decisions that are made by local school boards that are inevitably going to conflict with one another? How in the world do you get harmony out of that?
Well, I'm not sure you do get harmony out of that. I think probably a certain amount of experimentation, allowing different schools to go different ways, is good. I think my point would be that right now, most of these decisions aren't made, the fundamental decisions aren't made by the local school board. They're made by an educational establishment or, to use the language of world views, by the reigning secular worldview of our intellectual life.
So there is something to the conservative charge that liberal liberal values
right.
do represent a sort of, for however, to whatever ends it operates, it's a kind of a monolith out there.
Well, I think that's right. Conservatives are right about that. I mean, think about this, for example. Liberals get very upset about having a graduation prayer that is non-sectarian and fairly brief and general. Don't impose your religious values on me.
Uh-huh.
But then when you think about it from the religious conservative's point of view, their kids are taught over and over again that evolution happened and that God wasn't part of the process. Condoms are handed out in the schools, perhaps. They're taught that history doesn't have any overriding purpose. They're taught that morality is perhaps cultural relative. They're taught that people are self-interested utility maximizers.
Sounds like everybody's got something to be upset about here.
Well, that's right. But the point is that the fundamental values and beliefs of conservative religious folk, indeed, I would argue, liberal religious people as well, are contradicted over and over again as part of the education because we aren't, number one, we don't make room for allowing the religious voices into the conversation, but number two, we teach students to think about the world in fully, oftentimes militantly, secular ways, and we do so uncritically by failing to make students aware of the fact that there are alternatives.
Fair enough. Warren, a footnote to our conversation. How did somebody who is clearly a part of the secular, liberal, quote-unquote, educational establishment in this country, again, at one of our major research universities, UNC Chapel Hill, I'm talking about you. How did you come to write a book about religion and religious values in our education when you announce yourself at the beginning of your book as what, militantly agnostic? You're not going to talk about belief and truth.
I say I'm going to be agnostic for the purposes of the book.
Right.
I think the key thing to say in response to your question is that my position in the book is a secular liberal position. Most everyone assumes that if you believe religion should be part of an education, you must have a religious agenda, and perhaps you're a closet fundamentalist.
Right.
No, that's not the case. There are good secular liberal reasons. As a matter of fact, I think absolutely overpowering secular liberal reasons for including religion as part of an education. If we are to educate students liberally, if we are to encourage critical thinking, if we're to have the kind of neutrality the Establishment Clause requires, then students have got to be exposed to the various voices in our cultural marketplace, religious as well as secular.
Warren Nord is the author of Religion and American Education, now available in paperback from the University of North Carolina Press. Warren Nord directs the program in the Humanities and Human Values at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 785. That's $10, program number 785. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Mystery Woman. Join me for a conversation about youth, murder, and the sexual climate of Jacksonian America. My guest will be historian Patricia Klein Cohen of the University of California at Santa Cruz. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.